Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people whose intelligence I've admired for the longest time and benefited greatly from in terms of collaboration over the 30 years the Center for Security Policy has been in operation is Dr. J. Michael Waller. These days, he is the Vice President for Governmental Relations at the Center for Security Policy, but a man with a broader portfolio that takes into account, among other things, his academic training and firsthand experience with the black arts of political warfare. Michael Waller has just penned a decision brief from the Center that has as its focus the need for upping our game dramatically as a nation in that part of the battle space of the war for the free world, and I'm anxious to have him talk a little bit about it. J. Michael Waller, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to be back.
This conversation is, of course, taking place in the context, Mike, of a lot of thrashing going on, as it has been for all of the Trump presidency, to be clear, but particularly the past fortnight or so. Namely, the claims and counterclaims, the charges, the allegations, the prosecutorial aspects of this controversy about, did Russia try to influence the 2016 election to the extent that they did it make any difference? And most especially, did they do so in some sort of collusion with President Trump, at the time candidate Trump, or any of his minions in the Trump campaign, or for that matter, of transition? If you could, in the shortest of short forms, Mike, give us kind of an overview of whether there's anything new here under the sun as relates to the Kremlin's behavior, or whether the president's response to it thus far has been understandable, if not entirely what one might have called for.
Well, this is nothing new. This has been going on for 90 years, where you've had the Kremlin actively interfering in most presidential elections. It's just Trump's opponents make it look like it's something new for 2016, when really the newness of it is that, if anything, as Putin said the other day, Putin hoped Trump would win. Previously, the Kremlin has always wanted the Democrats to win, and I think that's the new variable why the Dems are so upset this time.
But the question is whether, in point of fact, and admittedly, Putin said he was rooting for Trump, but you'd kind of expect him to say that with Trump standing next to him, wouldn't you? But knowing what you do, Mike, about the degree to which Hillary Clinton was essentially, well, it's hardly an exaggeration to say, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Kremlin, that it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't have been perfectly happy having her in the job and continuing to work their will with her as they had on, Uranium One and Skolkovo and so much more.
Sure. I think Putin was really trolling Trump because he took a lot of subtle jabs at Trump during the public parts of the Helsinki summit. If I was a KGB planner, I would certainly want Hillary to win because she's predictable. She's knowable. She's a known quantity and she's easier to manipulate, whereas Trump is completely unpredictable. And that's sort of the worst type of person you would ever want. So I think that would put to rest, just from sheer logic, why the Russians would really want Trump to win. The bigger issue, though, is, as you said, the degree of Democrat co-optation by the KGB over the past 90 years, going up back to FDR, even before the Franklin Roosevelt administration.
Yeah, our friend Diana West's book, American Betrayal, is a fabulous chronicling of all of that. And it goes on. You know, I don't think there's a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats' agenda and that laid out by Vladimir Putin at the beginning of the Helsinki summit press conference on issue after issue, constraining missile defenses, arms control, despite Russian violations, preventing weapons from being put into space, and so on. To hear them talk about it, it sounds as though they're the most robust of hardliners on the Russians. Ain't necessarily so, folks, I guess is the bottom line. Hey, Mike, quickly, you are, as I mentioned, the author of a decision brief that we'll be publishing in the course of the day today at the Center for Security Policy. It will be on our securefreedom.org website by the time this program airs, and I encourage everyone to check it out. It talks about the idea of, in the face of all of this Russian and before that Soviet activity, finally really arming ourselves here in the United States with an in-kind, well, you call it political warfare deterrent. Talk us through what that looks like and how it might be effectively utilized.
Well, the most effective way to prevent someone from messing with you is to develop the ability to mess with him.
Peace through strength, I think, is what it's described as by some.
Right, exactly. But if I know that I'm going to have my government ruined by an opponent, if I act in an underhanded way toward that opponent, then I'm really not going to be prone to undermining that opponent in that way. It's one thing to do it in, say, a diplomatic conflict like we would normally have with Putin. It's another thing to undermine our election and subvert our constitutional system. Donald Trump has a really great asset right now, and that is Putin is far weaker as a ruler than he looks. He projects an image of invincible strength, but he has built his whole rule on a house of cards inside Russia, playing one murderous oligarchical faction against another, and sucking all the wealth out of the regions of the country to the point where you have Russian nationalists in parts of Russia who want to secede from Russia, to say nothing of mass immigration from China and all these different minority groups inside the Russian Federation who want autonomy.
Including a lot of Sharia supremacists, it ought to be noted.
A lot of Sharia supremacists who were trained by communists, so they're the worst kind of all. But you have this big toxic mix that is coming undone in Russia, and it's only Putin's police state that's keeping it together. So if Trump could simply say that he was going to put together the capability to subvert Russia, to use as a deterrent to prevent Russia from subverting American democracy and, say, our NATO allies, then I think you're going to see Putin use the tools he has at his disposal to stop any kind of subversion of us. And if not, we'll just have to undermine him and take him down.
Yeah, there are those who argue, and I think you're one of them, Mike Waller, that we ought to be trying to pull Putin away from China, that China really is the main adversary of our time, though what Putin has been doing to amass this immense, modern, and very threatening nuclear force makes him somebody we've got to be paying attention to on that score, too. But just very quickly, Mike, your thoughts on the prospects for him actually becoming more of a strategic partner rather than the adversary that he is now, if we take the sorts of steps you're recommending.
Yeah, I think he could be a strategic non-adversary. Putin is finding his country being gobbled up by China. Remember, his population is the size of Nigeria and his economy is the size of Spain. And he's right there bordering China with massive Chinese illegal immigration to really overrunning parts.
Siberia in particular. We have got to leave it at that. Mike Waller, I thank you so much for what you do for us at the Center for Security Policy. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by one of the country's preeminent experts and the most articulate commentators about what's going on in Asia and what it means for us. He is, of course, the inimitable Gordon Chang. You see him frequently at Fox News and in other media outlets. You can find his writings at The Daily Beast, The National Interest, and elsewhere. And you can find him each week, I'm proud to say, right here at Secure Freedom Radio. Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
I understand I'm welcoming you back from the Aspen Institute's summer program, and I wanted to ask you about some things that were said out there about China in particular, notably something that Michael Collins, who I think runs the CIA's East Asia Mission Center, he said, I'm told, Gordon, that the goal of Xi Jinping, the leader of China, is to replace the U.S. as the leading power in the world. This is not a newsflash, I think, to listeners of this program, thanks in part to your excellent teaching on the subject. But I did think it was important to take note of the fact that this is being acknowledged by a senior U.S. government intelligence official, and also would be very interested in drawing you out as to what a world in which China has supplanted the United States would look like.
Yeah, Michael Collins said this, and it is refreshing. It is important that he acknowledged this, because far too long, the Central Intelligence Agency and other parts of the U.S. government, U.S. Presidents, have failed to actually say this in public. You know, China, of course, is in competition with the United States, and one can always expect that within an international system, you know, countries will jockey for influence. What is important is that China is not only trying to compete with the United States, but the means which it uses, which are extremely predatory, many of them dangerous, aggressive, provocative, belligerent. Also, we got to remember that China not only wants to compete with the U.S. inside the international framework, it wants to revolutionize the world. It wants to change that framework. Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has been dropping hints that China is the world's only sovereign state, or should be, and that he wants to replace it with something that looks like China's imperial system, where everybody acknowledged China's authority and sovereignty under heaven, and that we were all just here to pay tribute to the glorious Chinese. So we've got to remember that the Chinese are actually saying this in public, and they've put us on notice.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like the kind of world most of us would like to be in, I think it's fair to say, Gordon, and it therefore behooves us to be doing what we can to resist it. We had at Aspen as well a statement from Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, to the effect that the most significant spy threat we're facing these days is from Chinese espionage. Again, not news to you, certainly, and I think probably to most of our listeners, but Gordon, just remind us of the extent to which this effort to supplant us is actually manifesting itself in terms of aggressive intelligence collection and influence operations and even subversion on the part of the Chinese right here in the United States.
Well, certainly. You know, we're seeing the Chinese not only try to gather information, which countries tend to do, they're also actively trying to change discourse in our country. They are organizing, for instance, Chinese students to demonstrate on U.S. soil. They send their agents here to intimidate Americans who are Americans and others who are in the United States legally. So therefore, this is an operation which is inconsistent with our sovereignty. The United States needs to insist on this. When I first heard President Trump talk about sovereignty, I thought that was so out of place. And then I started to realize the Chinese challenge to what we are and what we're doing. And then I realized it was extremely appropriate that we are sovereign. And then we take it for granted that we are. From the Chinese perspective, it's not so clear from the hints that Xi Jinping and others have been dropping, saying, as I mentioned before, that we need to go to a whole new system which revolutionizes and supplants the Westphalian system, which is the basis of our international system today.
Yeah. Gordon, speaking of intelligence collection by the Chinese, I was really struck by something that Congressman Louis Gohmert mentioned in the course of his exchanges, other parts of which got a lot more attention, it must be said, with Peter Strzok in his appearance recently before the House Judiciary Committee. And Congressman Gohmert referred to something that was news to me, not altogether surprising, frankly, but still news to me and I think to others, namely that apparently there was some software that had been injected into Hillary Clinton's email system back in the course of her inappropriate and I think actually illegal, you know, homebrew server episodes as Secretary of State, that actually forwarded all but four of some 30,000 emails to some foreign entity. I have been told pretty reliably that that foreign entity was a Chinese front company here in the United States. Do you have any thoughts, Gordon, on what it might mean that the Chinese would have had access to all of her email traffic for 4 years or so, perhaps?
Well, certainly, they knew everything that the United States was doing. When the email server scandal broke, people had speculated that the Chinese were reading all of the Secretary of State's emails. And then it was just sort of almost a joke that people were talking about it. But clearly, the Chinese have been reading not only her email traffic, but I'm sure the email traffic of other cabinet officials. This is something where the Chinese have devoted special attention to. And because of previous presidents failing to acknowledge the issue, you know, the Chinese have been able to make almost unresisted advances for quite a long time. So, you know, right now we're at a point where it's good that, for instance, FBI Director Wray talks about this. And it's very important because, you know, in previous administrations, many agencies in other parts of the federal government were preventing the FBI from actually going forward with its investigations of China, as we have learned. And so, therefore, we just need to have a full understanding of what's going on. So, yes, Secretary Clinton clearly had her emails read by the Chinese. So did others. And this is something that we have to recognize, the all-encompassing challenge.
Yeah. When you say so did others, you're speaking at the very least of the people who were corresponding with Hillary Clinton, which included the President of the United States and an awful lot of other foreign and domestic leaders.
Frank, we should assume that nothing that goes on the web is not at some point read by the Chinese. We should assume that all phone conversations, all emails have been intercepted by the Chinese. And, you know, it's not only their special determination, it's been our failure to defend ourselves. There's a number of U.S. presidents who I think will be marked down by history for their inability to discuss this issue in public and to defend ourselves.
Yeah, this is the key point, protect ourselves against it. Gordon, one last item on China, and then I did want to turn to North Korea quickly. You have a piece at the National Interest last week in which you talked about China bringing down the global economy. Talk a little bit about the essence of that piece, and is this willingly doing so as a sort of act of retribution, or is this simply because their own economy is beginning to show the strains of the economic warfare that finally Donald Trump is waging against it?
It's the latter, Frank. The Chinese economy right now is in serious stress. We can see it that the renminbi, the Chinese currency against the dollar, had its worst month in history last month as it declined 3.25%. The tumble has continued this month. The stock markets are the worst performing around the world. And so what we have is a China which is starting to show these signs of stress. In 2008, I think China was responsible for the global downturn in the sense that it, through predatory trade practices, built up enormous surpluses, didn't allow the Chinese people to enjoy the fruits of it. So therefore, the Chinese government had to recirculate the funds, created an enormous tide of liquidity in the U.S., which overwhelmed sensible regulation. This time, and that brought down the global economy. Then, this time it's going to occur because I think the Chinese economy is going to fail. They've had debt-fueled growth. Right now, they've got a debt crisis, a systemic debt crisis, which is going to occur. So, therefore, at this point, I'm just so worried that they are going to they're going to tank us again. But this time, they're going to feel it more than anybody else.
Well, you are, after all, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, so this may be the precursor to it. You're also the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, Gordon Chang, and I did want to ask you, fresh from your interview of General Vincent Brooks, the commander of U.S. forces in Korea, about a story that we've just seen concerning South Korea turning a blind eye to North Korean coal imports, disguised, to be sure, as Russian imports, but nonetheless knowing that they were coming from North Korea as evidence of, well, the South Korean government of President Moon evidently seeking to prop up this regime and enable it to do some of the things that we're increasingly concerned it's doing, despite the assurances that we're told Kim Jong-un gave President Trump about its change of course. Talk quickly about that, if you would, please, Gordon.
Yeah, the South Korean government by Moon Jae-in is very pro-North Korean. It's trying to shovel money to Kim Jong-un. The story here, of course, is not that they're bad actors. Yes, of course they are. Along with the Russians and the Chinese, the big story here is the Trump administration not enforcing sanctions. We have the means to understand what's going on and to stop, and we don't. So this, I think, is a U.S. issue rather than primarily a South Korea, Chinese, or Russian one.
Gordon, there's much more to talk about there. We're going to have to let it go at that for the moment, but we're going to be coming back to you next week and look forward to a further update from you. Congratulations on your successful time at the Aspen Institute, and appreciate very much your debrief on what went on there. Talk to you soon, my friend. Next up, we'll speak to Kevin Freeman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on economic warfare, is in the house virtually. He is our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy with a specialization in these matters. He is also the driving force behind a terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and also Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, a new forthcoming television product, and the author of two very important books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
We were just talking with Gordon Chang about what he is sort of assessing is a meltdown, I think it's fair to say, of the Chinese economy, one with very ominous implications for the rest of the globe's economic affairs. He mentioned in passing, and I wanted to drill down on it with you, essentially, a currency war, and whether China is actually waging it or whether it is simply unable, through the variety of other things that are at work, including President Trump's economic warfare against China at the moment, unable to do anything about the freefall of the renminbi. What are your thoughts, Kevin, and the implications for, among other things, our own currency and the replacement of it as the reserve currency of the world?
Well, first, currency wars are a natural follow-on of trade wars. One of the ways you gain trading advantage is you devalue your currency, and therefore your goods and services appear more cheaply in the global marketplace, and you're able to then recapture the market share that the tariffs of trade wars might have taken away from you. And so that is the reason that most economists are looking that direction. Now, Gordon's point is a different point. Gordon's point is, and as he said for quite some time, China's economy is failing. And because it's failing, there's a capital flight out of China. Business people in China want to get their money out as rapidly as they possibly can. That the economy is built up with massive amounts of debt. It's no longer working. And as a result, the currency is going to start to depreciate. And the third factor we've got is the Federal Reserve in the United States is raising rates, which makes the dollar, the benchmark by which all other currencies are judged, appear stronger because we see increasing interest rates. All those things are going on, and to a certain degree, all three of those are true. China is having troubles with their currency. They are not necessarily purposely, they're not the strong economy where we're going to purposely lower to gain a trading advantage. Some of this is natural market forces because the Chinese economy, although it's officially reported in the 6-7% annual growth range, has underlying enormous amounts of problems, and they have the massive amount of debt from the One Belt, One Road policy, where they're loaning money to these countries around them that are not in good credit shape themselves. So they're making essentially risky loans. So all of this puts pressure on their currency, and all of it at the same time that we've got this trade war going on.
And what does it mean for their seemingly concerted effort as part of really the larger one I discussed with Gordon a moment ago, of Xi Jinping to supplant the U.S. as the leading power of the world, to perhaps begin by supplanting the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, knowing that it will have very profound implications on our debt and other geostrategic abilities as well.
Well, the Chinese don't view making the dollar weaker or stronger as the means by which of supplanting the dollar as the reserve currency. Whether it's strong or weak is actually irrelevant to their very long-term goal of making the world de-dollarized. And the way that they're achieving the de-dollarization, which is actually hurting their currency and helping ours to a certain degree, is they're going out and using Chinese debt to loan to all of these countries with the One Belt and One Road. They're using their influence to say, stop using dollars, start trading in other currencies. So it doesn't matter whether the dollar is weak or strong during the process. They're trying to get other nations to stop using dollars as the primary currency of exchange. And they're doing both simultaneously. Our dollar is getting stronger, but that doesn't mean that the reserve status is getting stronger.
Fascinating. Kevin, let me ask you about a related subject in connection with all of this activity by the Chinese. Our friend Steve Bannon, a colorful figure, particularly as a result of his time with the Trump campaign and then the early days of the Trump presidency, recently returned from Europe to do a program with CNBC in which he came flat out and said what I think we have both felt for quite some time and said in our respective capacities, that China is actually at war with the United States. You've talked about this in connection with the economic and unrestricted warfare components of it. Talk a little bit about what Steve Bannon said and the implications of it.
Well, it's quite an amazing thing. You spoke at the Alpha Conference, and you know, Steve, as you mentioned, is a very colorful figure. Yet he was treated with sufficient respect, put him on television for a good period, and asked questions at the conference, was interested in, to hear what he had to say. And what he said was that China has been at war with us economically, and we are now at war with them for the first time in 20 years. And he reflected what many people believe to be Trump's doctrinal position, that China is the number one enemy and that we need to do everything we can to protect our intellectual property, mostly to protect our technological advantage that we've had. Because if China, with their military and with their controlled economy and so forth, gains a technological advantage over the United States, it could spell trouble. That's what's protected us for these past couple of decades. So he made the point very strongly that the Trump administration is aware that the war is ongoing and that we're doing what we need to do. And the amazing thing is that the Wall Street has begun to adopt an awareness that China is a bad actor and there are problems. Not completely, but more so than I've seen in 10 years.
You have just recently published at your blog posts, globaleconomicwarfare.com, one that suggests, as I have as well, that perhaps what President Trump is doing with Vladimir Putin and others, arguably Kim Jong-un and the like, is to try to peel off some of China's allies and enablers or proxies, and do so with a view to countering what China represents in terms of the threat to us. Walk us through that, Kevin. I think this is a really important point.
Yes, and I'm hopeful. The title of the blog is, if this isn't the Trump doctrine, it ought to be. What I walked through was that this Russia collusion narrative is highly partisan and political. It's designed not to really point out the truth that Russia is a bad actor state, has been for quite some time. Putin is a problem. Of course he hacked things. Of course they have manipulated and used things for their benefit. But they are largely, in my mind, more akin to a criminal state than a communist plan to take over the world. And Putin has sided with China because it suited his needs, but Putin has a greater threat from China long term than he does from the United States. And as a result, we ought to use that relationship and separate China from Russia, much the same way that Nixon is famously said to have separated China from the Soviet Union to our benefit. We ought to separate Russia from China to our benefit. And I basically laid that case out.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but I'm hoping it is his policy, and I think it certainly should be. And this is a moment when it would, I believe, be helpful for him to explain to the American people this this broader vision, if indeed that is what's at work. Speaking of broader vision, one of the pieces that seems to me to be worth a comment from you, Kevin Freeman, was written by Bethany Ellen Ibrahimian at the Daily Beast. And it talks about an aspect of Chinese influence operations that generally doesn't get the attention it warrants. Her report involves a campaign that apparently is now being run by the Chinese government to try to get provisions that the House of Representatives included in the annual National Defense Authorization Act stripped from the final legislation in conference between the House and Senate. And they're objecting, I gather, to elements that deal with things like missile defenses and exercises and Arctic policy and the Chinese tech giants Huawei and ZTE, Taiwan, Hong Kong, the Chinese meddling in democracies and even the Confucius Institutes that they've created here. Your thoughts, Kevin, as to what this kind of effort using American lobbying firms, including one that employs John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, to try to influence our legislative process. What are your thoughts?
Well, first off, this is pure and simple economic warfare. It's using money as a weapon to hinder your adversary in some way and using lobbying. I recall when I spoke at the Heritage Foundation a few years ago, I had a lady of Chinese descent clearly come to me and mentioned that she was working at one of the universities in the China Studies program. And I looked at her and I said, "You're PLA, People's Liberation Army, aren't you?" And she said, "Why, yes." And she smiled. And I said, "Well, did I say anything about Chinese unrestricted warfare that was wrong?" She said, "No." I said, "Am I having to look over my shoulder?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, I just said this in Washington." She said, "Doesn't matter." I said, "Why?" She said, "We own half this town." And I said, "What about the other half?" And she said, "The Saudis own that."
Fascinating. I'm laughing not because it's funny, but because it is really outrageous and tragic, but absurd that we've let this happen. Kevin Freeman, this is one of the reasons why we value so much our weekly visits with you and the opportunity to collaborate on all that you do. I hope you will come back to us again next week and that we'll have a chance to visit a bit further about all of this and perhaps also the Pakistani election that will take place in the meantime. We're going to talk a bit about that with Dr. Colonel Lauren Sullen right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back joined by Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sullen, a combat veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq in the United States Army Reserves. He is a PhD with a specialization in pathology, a physiologist, if you will, having worked, among other places, as at the U.S. Army's Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. He knows his way around chemical warfare, among other things, and we're going to talk to him about in a moment about some of the findings, interesting indeed, of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in Syria. But before we do that, I wanted to pick his brains about a subject that he's deeply knowledgeable about, in part based on his experience in Central and South Asia, namely Pakistan, which has presidential elections coming up here shortly. And I wanted to get his thoughts on what's likely to come of them and what it might mean for the future trajectory of Pakistan. Dr. Colonel, it's good to have you back. How are you, sir?
No, thank you, Frank.
So let me ask you, there is a man by the name of Imran Khan who came to great prominence in Pakistan as a cricket player of a very, very high quality. He is now in contention to become the next prime minister, if the polls are correct, that his celebrity and one other attribute may be bringing him to the fore. It's been described in some places in the West as populism, the sort of Trump variety, and I wanted to get your take on that. Is he a populist or something else?
Well, he's not a populist in the sense of President Trump. He's probably more of a populist in the sense of a Bernie Sanders. Although he's talking a lot about fixing the corruption in Pakistan and creating a kind of welfare, or I should say Islamic welfare state in Pakistan, he is really being backed very strongly by the military, which is the traditional power in Pakistan. So it becomes a bit of a stretch in reality to say that he is a true populist in the true nature of the term.
And let me just drill down on this Islamist business, because it's my understanding that his program has actually drawn upon support from and indeed involved in his campaign some pretty unsavory Sharia supremacists of the violent jihadist stripe. Is that right? And what does that say about his own proclivities in this regard?
Yes, that's absolutely true, Frank. What Imran Khan has done has been a lot of pandering to the extremist religious groups in Pakistan. In fact, as a result of that, a lot of the voters are referring to him as Taliban Khan.
That's not a good sign. There's a lot of Taliban in Pakistan as it is, let alone having somebody in the prime minister's office who's actually quite aligned with them. So one of the things that we've been talking about for some time, Lawrence Sellin, is what China is doing, and we're much about China in the course of this program today and most weeks. What is China up to with Pakistan, and how is that likely to affect the outcome of this election and the policies that an Imran Khan perhaps may pursue should he be elected?
Well, it's interesting that you brought it up, Frank, because China is second only to the military in terms of having influence on the Pakistani election. As you know, China has invested mainly in loans in Pakistan in what is called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So it has a huge vested interest in Pakistan and the financial condition of Pakistan, which is really grave at this point. So they are trying to influence the election in the background. In fact, it is interesting that Imran Khan did a bow to China recently in terms of forming a committee that would be directly devoted towards Pakistani-Chinese relationship and the development, economic development in Pakistan with reference to China.
This is a very interesting point. I'm struck by a report out of the Wall Street Journal, Lawrence, that talked about the building spree that the Chinese have been engaged in, much of it financed by their debt, is running into trouble, that the Chinese are finding the Pakistanis a little bit less accommodating in terms of the dictates, that the strings, if you will, that go along with the debt financing of these infrastructure projects. So have you been tracking that, and what are the implications of that?
Yes, Frank, you're absolutely right about that, because the Chinese have given Pakistan a lot of loans. In fact, just recently, they gave them another $2 billion to shore up their Pakistan's foreign reserves. And there are a lot, as you say, there are a lot of strings attached to the Chinese investment in Pakistan. For example, and they're also doing this in Africa, by the way, for example, they insist upon Chinese workers coming and working in Pakistan. So what you have is a net outflow of jobs from Pakistan and a net increase in imports from China to Pakistan. And this has become a serious contentious issue in the Pakistani elections, because the people are starting to take notice of this and are objecting.
Now, you have mentioned in the past, the possibility that to the extent that all of this Chinese involvement is not in our interest, that we might be able to contribute further to their difficulties, among other things, by collaborating with and otherwise assisting the aspirations of the people known as the Baluchis, who aspire to some sort of national independence of their own. Walk us through that quickly, if you would, Lawrence Sellin.
Well, that's true, Frank. What Chinese are trying to do is gain global domination through what they call the Belt and Road Initiative. Now, the key component of the Belt and Road Initiative is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which, as we just discussed, is in a precarious situation just on finances alone. But also, if you want to deter what China is doing globally, you focus on that particular aspect in Pakistan. One of the key elements to stop China in Pakistan is by the ethnic separatism issue. As you bring up, the Baluchis have had a longstanding insurgency in Baluchistan seeking at least self-determination, possibly independence. And now the Pashtuns in Pakistan are following in the same route. So if you want to actually inhibit what China is doing in Pakistan and the Belt and Road Initiative globally, you would, as you say, address the issues of ethnic separatism in Pakistan.
Yeah, seems like a plan. Let me ask you about one other issue. We've talked about this in the past. You expressed skepticism, as have others, about the narrative that was officially adopted by the United States government and others internationally with respect to a particularly heinous attack allegedly by the Assad government in Syria against its own people using chemical weapons. It precipitated, in response, a major military strike by aircraft and cruise missiles at President Trump's direction shortly thereafter. The skepticism that you've expressed now seems to have been validated by this so-called Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Tell us about their recent findings and where that leaves us in this matter.
Well, let me just introduce that by saying that on April 7th, the Syrian rebels accused the Syrian government of launching a chemical attack using nerve agents and chlorine gas on rebel positions in the city of Douma. Now, the rebels provided what they described as evidence of that by releasing a number of videos and images. Now, I looked at them when they came out, and I personally could not conclude based on that that there was a chemical attack.
And again, that's drawing on your experience in the chemical warfare business and physiology and so on. You've drawn that conclusion independently. But so what did they come up with?
Well, what the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons came up with, their conclusion was, it came out 2 weeks ago, that there was no use of a nerve agent. And the only evidence that there was of chlorine gas were what is called chlorinated hydrocarbons. And as you know, Frank, a chlorinated hydrocarbon, for example, is the household item of carbon tetrachloride. So it is their evidence is inconclusive that a chemical attack occurred on April 7th.
Wow. Much more to talk about on all of these counts. We'll look forward to doing so with you, Dr. Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, retired colonel. I appreciate the work you do. Thank you for taking the time, and we'll look forward to doing so with you again in the near future. I hope that we'll be able to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.